What is the fucking crack, you bin bag Corinthians? How are you getting on? Welcome to episode 85 of the Blind Boy Podcast. Great response to last week's podcast, which was about emotions. It was about the nature of emotions and what have you. But a great response to that. Thank you very much for all the lovely DMs and comments that I got from it, and people saying that some of the information was helpful to their lives and existence. I had one person on Instagram say that last week's podcast caused them to quit their job. So, fair fucking play. I hope that it works out in a meaningful fashion and it not in a Michael Douglas in Falling Down type of way. I hope I didn't inspire that. I hope I just inspired that person to try and seek another job that gives them a sense of meaning, which would be a good thing. Not Michael Douglas in Falling Down, please. I wanted to do a hot take episode at some point, which, if you haven't seen Falling Down with Michael Douglas, give it a look. A very, very good film from the early 90s. I suppose you'd call it a cult film. You would, you know, not a lot of people remember it. I'm not a huge fan of Michael Douglas. Michael Douglas famously claimed he got fucking throat cancer from giving lickouts. Not a huge fan of Michael Douglas. I just don't like the films he's in. I think he overacts a lot. That's just me. But in Falling Down, he's amazing. It's just, it's a man in Los Angeles who just decides he doesn't want to, just quits his fucking job and goes on a murderous rampage. Very good, tense film with a nice build-up. I do enjoy it. Excellent use of what you'd call golden hour, which is when you shoot a film in either at dawn or at sunset in order to get a particularly orange sideways light. And Los Angeles has a great example of this. This is why Los Angeles is always kind of orangey in films. Falling Down is a good example. But I had a hot take. I want to do an episode on it, that the roots of the film Falling Down, how it's structured, is how Grand Theft Auto video games are structured. That would be a future hot take podcast with once I leave it brew in my head a bit more. New listeners, if you're a new listener, go back to some of the older episodes. Maybe even go to the start. Oh, I've got a gammy vape. Sorry about the cough. New listeners, go to the start of the podcast. Don't just start now. Even though we have this desire to start things that are new, you can listen to a podcast from a year ago. Won't matter. So, this week's podcast was going to be about something completely different. I had a hot take planned, but a different hot take than the one I'm going to go with this week. Because the one I'm going to go with this week, I ended up researching into it accidentally. I fell into a bit of a good fucking internet hole. Like, when I get a decent hot take, and a decent hot take for me means when I go into a type of flow, but the flow is a research flow. When I'm on the internet, you know, start off on Wikipedia, go to some articles, whatever, and I find myself really enjoying what I'm reading, really engaged, really interested, researching, but the type of research that it feels like I'm being creative. It pops off different creative parts of my brain, even though I'm not engaged in a creative activity. That's where hot takes come from. It's where not just hot takes come from, that's where short stories come from. Like, I know from any creativity, if I'm reading and researching something and I'm so truly engaged in it that I've kind of lost sense of my surroundings, I know that that is my mind storing all that information I'm reading for the benefit of my unconscious, and one day, could be 3 years' time, it will bubble up as a creative idea. And I know that feeling. So tonight, I ended up reading about tenements, because the Irish Minister for Housing, Eoghan Murphy, the government, like, there's a huge housing crisis in Ireland, a massive housing crisis, and the government at the moment are trying to put forward this suggestion that Irish people should get used to living in accommodation where, we'll say, it's a huge building, multiple people, multiple families, but you essentially just live in a room, you sleep in a room, but the living area, which means the living room and the kitchen and the toilet, that these spaces are communal. So you have multiple families sharing the same living space. And the Irish government are now seriously rolling this out as a suggestion to solve the fucking housing crisis. And it's an incredibly insulting suggestion, because what the Minister for Housing is suggesting there is, we've had that before. And it, that type of living, they were called tenements, okay? And tenements were, like, they came about in the Industrial Revolution when society as a whole moved from, you know, an agrarian population where people were widely dispersed in the countryside to all of a sudden everyone living in cities and working in factories. All of a sudden you have this huge density of people. So around the kind of late 1700s, 1800s, tenements come about, which is poor people working in factories with very little rights, working from 6 in the morning till fucking 10 at night, and then living in these tenements, multiple families, sharing living spaces, sharing kitchens if they had them, and sharing toilets. And tenements were so bad in the late 1900s and early 20th century. They were so bad that any modernized development in public housing that came about in the 20th century was a direct response to how bad tenements were. Like, flats and apartments were a response to, Jesus, this tenement situation is fucking disgraceful. All it does is spread disease and filth and poverty and crime. This is an inhumane way for people to live. We must never repeat this. That's the history of 20th century housing. So now the Irish fucking housing minister is essentially proposing tenements, but under a different way. He's trying to package it like an episode of Friends. Do you know, it's like, you get to be Ross and you get to be Rachel. Sure, they just, you know, hung out in the same apartment and went to a coffee shop and they were gorgeous. All of them. Wouldn't you like that? It's like, no, it's going to be tenements, sir. You fucking dope. So I started researching tenements, and I ended up in a good internet rabbit hole, we'll call it. And I'm a bit of a digital hipster. So when I go into internet holes, I enjoy a bit of Wikipedia, okay? I do enjoy a Wikipedia hole is fine, but it's the hipster in me. I don't like reading. Like, if I go to the Wikipedia article on tenements, I'm like, this is interesting, but the hipster in me feels like I'm listening to Rihanna, and I don't want to listen to Rihanna. I want to listen to some 80s disco music. So I end up doing this type of digital hipsterism where a good internet hole for me is when I'm looking at reading books from like the 1700s or 1600s. There's a lot of really good, like, free books on either on Amazon Kindle or on Google Books that were written 200 years ago, and you can consider them to be original sources, and they're kind of hard to find, but you can still find them if you know how to look. So when I get into a really decent internet hole, I'm getting stuck into these really old books, and it makes me feel like it's the hipster in me. It's like, wow, I'm discovering something new here. I'm reading this book, and I might only be the sixth person on the internet to open it, or something like that, you know? So I ended up in one of these holes tonight, and found some really fucking interesting shit that just started sparking the hot take part of my brain. So I have some stuff planned for you that I want to talk about. if you're interested in any, what recommendations could I give you? Like, because I went through a period there about 5 years ago. I'd gotten a Kindle as a present, but I didn't have any money to buy any books for the Kindle. So I ended up, like, there's loads and loads of free books on Kindles. Most of them, unfortunately, are really shit erotic novels. You'd be surprised what you can find, actually. There's erotic literature on Kindles, and I think it's generated by artificial intelligence. I don't even think a human writes it. But if you go deep enough into free erotic literature on Kindles, you'll find erotic books about dinosaurs fucking humans. Not a bother. But I digress. The best free Kindle books are just really, really old textbooks and encyclopedias and things like that. The 1811 Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue is a fantastic free fucking book that you'll get on Google or Kindle. And what it is, it's a dictionary of language that would be spoken in the streets, we'll say. Posh Brits would have written it, and it was them trying to understand the language of, we'll say, the peasant classes. And it's fascinating because you find so many words. Like, this was 1811, so many words we use today. It will have the word in there, and then it'll have its roots. So many of them, they're mainly Irish words that were anglicised, or words from what they'd call thieves' cant, which I believe is Romany language, I think. Thieves' cant, and then a few others. So the 1811 Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue is good. And there's another book that's free called English as It's Spoken in Ireland by a fella called W.P. Joyce. So you can get them online for free and they're good crack. So tonight I ended up, this one wasn't free actually, I think I ended up paying for it, but I found this old book and a lot of other really, really old ones. And the book that got me started was, what was it called now? 2 seconds. It was a history of political violence in Ireland amongst the peasantry, we'll say. I think it's called Irish Peasants, Violence and Political Unrest from 1780 to 1914. So I ended up looking into this and finding some really interesting shit. And what initially attracted me to the book was the political unrest, the political element of violence by the Irish peasantry. So that's what I kind of went in there for. But then I came out of it with something different. And I will probably do a separate podcast on the political element of organised violence in Ireland. And I'm not talking about the shit we kind of commonly talk about, you know, the wars of rebellion, but much more sporadic grassroots community violence within Ireland, usually against landlords and different eccentric groups that come about and how that interacts with folk culture. That's a separate podcast. What I want to talk about this week is the Irish tradition of faction fighting, which is something I hadn't thought about faction fighting since school, because I remember in sixth class history, a teacher talking about faction fights and the history and tradition of it in Ireland, and I kind of left it at that and didn't really think of it until today when I was reading. So where my interest kind of starts and what excited me is an initial kind of a fact I came across that's rooted in Limerick. Okay, and Limerick is going to feature a lot across this hot take. So in Limerick, there's a famous Limerick character called Sylvester O'Halloran. And Sylvester O'Halloran, like, there's a bridge in Limerick named the Sylvester O'Halloran Bridge near the old courthouse. It's a small little walkway bridge. So I always have known this as Sylvester O'Halloran Bridge, but only in recent years I battered my hole to figure out who Sylvester O'Halloran was. Well, Sylvester O'Halloran was a world-renowned Irish surgeon from Limerick who operated in the late 1700s. So I think he died in like 1808 or something. So he was a surgeon in the 1700s, which is kind of just at the time of the Enlightenment. Do you know, if you're a surgeon in the 1700s, that's fairly fucking hardcore, because before the Enlightenment, you weren't allowed to operate on corpses, you know, that the religion really kind of determined what you could and couldn't do with a dead body, so medicine suffered. But at the time of the Enlightenment, it became okay all of a sudden to dissect corpses and learn about surgery. So Sylvester O'Halloran from Limerick, as a surgeon and a doctor, is a kind of a world-renowned pioneer in medicine. What made it even more class is that he was a Catholic and he was operating as a surgeon during the penal laws, which, you know, the penal laws were these, it was a massive political and social system of racism against Irish Catholics in our own country that forbade Catholics from owning land, passing land down to the fucking, down to your children, being in political life. You know, and a Catholic couldn't become a politician. A Catholic wasn't allowed to receive a proper education. So this is what makes Sylvester O'Halloran, as a world-renowned surgeon at the height of the penal laws, so class. And it's why he's got a bridge named after him in Limerick, and why the world owes its debt to Sylvester O'Halloran from Limerick and what he contributed to medicine. But what I found particularly fucking interesting is Sylvester O'Halloran made particularly meaningful contributions to the study and understanding of head injuries. And the reason Sylvester O'Halloran in the 1700s had such a great kind of knowledge and something to say about head injuries is because of the amount of head injuries that he was operating on in Limerick City in the late 1700s. So what I learned is that there was a lot of people getting their heads smashed in the area of Munster, right? Tipperary, Limerick, Clare, North Cork in particular. A lot of people were getting their heads bashed in, and Sylvester O'Halloran, as the main kind of surgeon and physician, on his day-to-day, he was the person who had to stitch their fucking heads up. I have some direct quotes. Now, I'm going to be doing a couple of direct quotes during this podcast. And there's a weird thing that podcasts do when they have to do direct quotes, where, like, I listen to Irish History Podcast, which I fucking love and I recommend you listen to. I've had Finn O'Dwyer from Irish History Podcast on as a guest before. But when Finn reads out quotes, direct quotes, what he does is he puts an echo on his voice, which is gas. So when I'm reading out a quote with this podcast, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read quotes out in the voice of your drunk Limerick aunt, because why not? So this is what Sylvester O'Halloran in 1789, I believe, had to say about fighting in Limerick. No part of the world can have such abundant material for such a study as Ireland, and foremost in Ireland for frequency of head injuries in Munster, the valour and fiery spirit of the people, their resentment of anything slighting or insulting, their addiction to strong drink. From these hitherto unrestrained causes, it is that many of our fair patrons and hurling matches terminate in bloody conflicts. I have had no less than 4 fractured skulls to trepan on a May morning, and frequently 1 or 2. So Sylvester O'Halloran in the mid-1700s was mostly dealing with Limerick people getting their heads bashed in from sticks. And this was because of the huge tradition in Limerick, Tipperary, North Cork and Clare in particular of what's known as faction fighting. So what faction fighting was, it was a cultural tradition. You see, it depends on who you listen to. When you listen to a British person describe the Irish tradition of faction fighting, it's tinged in massive racism. This is where the stereotype of the fighting drunk Irish comes from. That the Irish are this race of violent fighting people who will do nothing but drink and smash each other's heads in acts of violence. But when you read the Irish accounts of faction fighting from the day, it's like it was much more of a celebration and a skilled sport. Yes, you know, as Sylvester O'Halloran is saying, people were getting their fucking heads smashed in, but it wasn't fights out of anger. It was like organized matches between huge groups of people where you'd fight with sticks. Now, these sticks are what we would call, you know, the term shillelagh. Shillelaghs are weird because we don't associate fucking shillelaghs with Irishness. Or in Ireland, we don't think of shillelaghs. They're one of these things that they're mostly remembered in within Irish America. Irish Americans have much more of an affinity or an idea in their heads about shillelaghs than actual Irish people do. We don't really think of shillelaghs anymore. You might have had the odd owl lad with a blackthorn stick. But shillelaghs were a big deal in Ireland in the 1700s. Now, a lot of it was because the aforementioned penal laws. In the penal laws, it wasn't really acceptable for an Irish Catholic to have a sword. Gentlemen carried swords in the 1700s. It was normal for a posh gent to walk around with a sword on his belt, more for ceremonial reasons at that point. But the peasantry, the Irish peasantry, you couldn't have a fucking sword. So the Irish peasants had sticks made from blackthorn or oak with a cudgel at the end, like this big, the knob of a tree. So a stick about a metre long with a hard bit at the end. So faction fights, from the Irish perspective, were very organised fights between huge groups of people, gangs or factions, where they would engage in incredibly skilled combat, but also trying to bash each other's heads in and seriously injure each other with drink involved. Faction fighting had rules. Like, I'm not arguing for, you know, the saying that it's a good thing to be smashing heads off people. I'm not trying to say that, but what I am trying to do is I'm trying to decolonize faction fighting. Instead of presenting to you the British oppressive colonial racist narrative of out of control drunk paddies smashing each other's heads in, let's look at what faction fighting actually was. And some people say some of the rules, Yanks will call it shillelagh law. Like, we don't even know what the word shillelagh means. It doesn't appear to be rooted in Gaelic. It's probably a very old Irish word that got completely lost and was replaced with an anglicised pronunciation that we now call shillelagh, because shillelagh is not an Irish fucking name. It's not a Gaelic name. But some of the actual rules to a faction fight: if a faction is greatly outnumbered, members of the more numerous faction must join them in order to even the sides out. So if your faction has six people, and the other faction has 10, then you'll have to even the numbers out between both factions, even though you're supposed to be opposed gangs. So first off, that to me does not suggest that faction fighting is happening out of intense anger or spite, because otherwise you wouldn't be saying your gang has more than mine, can we have two a year people to come to our gang to even it out. That's quite an honourable thing, and points more in the direction of it being a sport than it being wanton fucking violence. Rule number two: if a third faction is involved, they should join with the less numerous faction. Number three: no attacking of one man by more than one man. So even though there could be 200 people in combat, it must be one on one at all times throughout the combat. If one man unfairly attacks another man, his own faction will attack him. So if you don't obey these rules, if you're in a gang and you break one of the rules, your own gang will attack you to defend the honour of the rules of this sport, essentially. The weapons used should be evenly matched, sticks versus sticks, etc. Number six, Depending on the situation, virtually any weapon can be used, including swords, stones and farm implements, although guns are to be avoided. Number 7. Punching, wrestling and kicking are allowed in some cases. Number 8. No striking of women, even if they strike you. Because women were involved in these faction fights too, it wasn't a male affair. If women wanted to be involved, they were allowed to be involved. But as you can see there, there is a rule saying, even if a woman hits you with a stick, you can't hit her back. So, that's, you know, that paints a different version of events to the, like I said, the British narrative of it being wanton violence. Like, I'll read you out now an account. This, I believe, is from 1810, right? And this, again, is a faction fight that happened in the heart of Limerick City in 1810. But the account comes from an English priest, a reverend who happened to be visiting. So this account of the faction fight, it's not sympathetic. It has, I'm sure a lot of it is true. And I don't think he was being a prick. But again, the anti-Irishness is present. He doesn't understand what's happening, basically. But here's a priest's account of a huge faction fight in Limerick in 1810. Notwithstanding all their improvements, here still remain many vestiges of barbarity. County against county, and often for reasons the most insignificant, to engage in pitched battles. I chanced to be a spectator of a battle of this description in Limerick, which in ferocity surpassed anything I had seen, and which indicates that at a distance from towns, civilization is making but little progress. The battle took place in consequence of a misunderstanding a few weeks before between two men at a neighbouring fair. In consequence, hundreds on each side engaged, and that too the very first holiday. Having therefore, according to agreement, met to fight at Limerick, they began about half an hour after prayers, but were separated by the magistrates. In the evening, however, about five, the whole street again being full of people, I observed one fellow, surrounded by hundreds, without a coat, raising his arm and grasping a thick blackthorn cudgel, about 4 feet long. He swung it around his head, pronouncing aloud, "Jesus be praised, Jesus be praised forever." After which, an opening of the crowd being made, he ran down the street, with hundreds after him, armed with cudgels, to meet the opposite party. In a few minutes, hundreds of cudgels in all directions were implied, the women as busy as the men. I observed one woman put a stone into the mouth of her glove, which she tied fast to prevent the stone coming out, and then knocked a man on the head, by which he came to the ground. Many of the women, having tied stones in the corners of their cloaks and pocket handkerchiefs, were implied in the same way. To the disgrace of the inhabitants, many of them shouted and applauded those that were most active, calling them by name from their windows, "Bravo, well done," while they hissed at those disposed to be quiet. In the evening, great numbers of boys, some of them not above 12, in imitation of the men, were fighting in good earnest, with sticks, scarcely any sticks from them. It was 10 at night before the streets could be cleared. In a public house into which I had stepped to see what was doing, a crowd being about the door, I found numbers of both sexes employed in clipping the hair clotted with blood from the heads of the combatants, and several shirts in the house red and stiff with blood. Man is, perhaps, the only animal that bleeds at the nose, though in health. So that's a priest describing an actual huge faction fight he saw in Limerick in 1810. And it sounds fucking amazing. Like, you've, first off, hundreds of people in the street kicking the fucking shit off each other. But then you've got the women picking up rocks and tying the rocks into their fucking gloves, baiting lads into the heads with their fists and rocks behind them, or getting the ends of their dresses and putting the rocks into the end of the dress and smashing people across the head with rocks on the end of the dresses. And the reason I'm, like, I don't want to be fucking judgmental about this, because, like, this is 1810. like, my own attitude now, to be honest, like, I'm a bit more like that English priest. That does sound barbaric to me. Like, but I'm someone living in 2019. I don't know what it's like to be a Limerick person in 1810 in the slums and tenements of Limerick. I don't know what the fuck that's like. This is a world where you have people living under the penal laws. You have a population with zero education in 1810, deeply religious, with no access to healthcare, huge infant mortality rates, under the boot of colonialism, very low life expectancy. I can't, in 2019, begin to empathise or understand what their attitude is towards violence, morality, their own mortality, propriety. I don't know. And, you know, you have to be cautious. Like, what's the difference between that and, like, that priest has been a bit of a prick. Are you telling me that the English bishops weren't blessing soldiers that went off into war and did the same shit? You know, by all accounts, the Irish there would have viewed that as a sport, and the people spectating viewed it as a sport, and they were celebrating the ones who were really getting stuck in and baiting heads, and they were denouncing the ones who were being chicken shits. And it appears to operate as a sport known as a faction fight between two factions. And I can't, in 2019, empathise with it. I want to take it at face fucking value. I don't want to take the British colonial narrative where that English priest right there is talking about how civilization has fallen. That's the language of, look at these savages, we must teach them. We must show them how to learn. But sure, like, the Brits are doing the same fucking thing with their armies. They just have nice uniforms and horses and medals, and that makes it okay. So I'm not going to take any side on that. I want to view this faction fight as a legitimate, pained expression of Irish culture. I want to view this faction fight as an expression of, like, no matter what time you live, it is toxic to smash someone's head in with a fucking stick. Okay? Let's not portray that ultimately as healthy. That's never a good thing, that expression of physical violence. But I want to look at it post-colonially and from a psychological perspective and a sociological perspective, and I want to view that type of organized expression of anger and anger at the fellow Irishman. When you're fucking colonized and you're under the penal laws and you have no hope and society says you're not allowed to exist, that energy has to go somewhere. And I think the faction fighting, that's where that energy went into a disciplined type of sport where, if you look at it from the outside, appears to be barbarous and appears to be savagery. But in the pained, hurt context of an Irish Catholic in the penal laws in the slums of Limerick in 1810 is understandable. That's where I want to go with my reading of it. Now, before we go into the ocarina pause, to add substance to what I'm kind of saying there, one thing we find when you read up about faction fights in Limerick around that time, and in Clare and in Tip and North Cork, they tend to happen, a lot of it around fair days or hurling matches. And now, hurling, which is the Irish national sport, and, like, I'm not really into sports. I don't have the gift of understanding sports, but at the same time, I do have a lot of respect for hurling because it is a native Irish sport that's thousands of years old. And but the thing is, when people who aren't from Ireland witness a hurling match, they do see it as violent. It's terrifying. I've seen French and Spanish people see hurling. Like, this is the fastest field game on earth, and it looks like a giant fight. And hurlies, or hurls, depending on what part of the country you're from, these sticks look like weapons. And this isn't a coincidence, because faction fighting and hurling in the 1700s, 1600s, 1800s, they were interconnected in a way. Now, my hot take is, because there's this narrative, and it's always the fucking Brits that say it. Brits, in an arrogant way, will say the British took the Irish, the uncivilized, unorganized Irish game of hurling, and gave it structure and rules. Because hurling now happens on a pitch. It happens in a defined area on a pitch with, I don't know what, 15 people each side, I'm not sure. 15 people each side, we'll say, and then one ball, a slither. Before that was the way, hurling would happen, you could have 50 people on either team, and everyone had a hurl, and you'd have one ball, and there was no pitch. A hurling match could take place across multiple fields. It could take place across 6 miles of basically 50 people on one team, 50 people on the other, baiting a ball miles and miles over the countryside. It would also often end in a faction fight, with the hurley being used as the weapon, because hurleys do look a lot like shillelaghs. And my hot take, I view that, again, in the context of colonialism. What that reminds me of is, there's a form of Brazilian martial arts called capoeira. And capoeira, it's about 400 years old, and it was developed by African slaves on Brazilian sugar plantations. Now, if you've ever seen people performing, fighting capoeira style, it's a very strange type of fighting. It looks like dancing. They're spinning on their heads to kick each other. There's a reason for that. Slave colonies in Brazil, when an argument would happen, people wanted to fight. They wanted to settle arguments with their fists. But the slave owners and the overseers of the plantation, they would not allow any fighting. Because if two slaves get into a fight and one of them breaks their arm, then you're down a fucking slave. So slave owners would not let Brazilian slaves fight. And if they saw any fighting, they would punish them with whipping. So Brazilian slaves developed a form of fighting that, if you're an overseer and you're trying to look at the slaves, what they would do is they'd start playing music, and they developed a form of fighting that from a distance looks like dancing. So that's why Brazilian capoeira is the way it is, and that's why people fight to drums. It's to confuse the overseer, to let them see from a distance, we're not fighting, we're just having a dance. In the meanwhile, they're kicking each other into the head, but you can't see it. That right there is pure post-colonial. Post-colonialism, for me, is the struggle that a culture has when it isn't allowed to develop, because there's rules there. The rose that grows from concrete. The concrete is the power structure, but the rose is that force of life, and it'll find its way out there. And capoeira is that. It's a rose that grows from concrete. It's still fighting, but it's this new, different way of doing it because there's strong rules. I view hurling and faction fighting in a similar way. The Irish wanted to express their faction fighting, and what better way to do it than to allow the onlooking aristocracy and the British ruling class and the penal laws, let them think that this is a game with a ball, and confuse them. And yes, there is a ball, and yes, there's 50 of us, and we're whacking it across a field, and yes, we want to win. But it's also a great excuse to walk around with your fucking wooden weapons and still express, have a drink and express your culture and smash the heads off each other, because that's how a downtrodden culture felt its need, its way to express itself in the early 1800s. That's how I do view it. And I also find it quite interesting, the use of hurleys as weapons. Like, even my granddad in West Cork in the 1920s, when he was in the IRA, when him and his column would train militarily, obviously, you know, the black and tans are all over the countryside. If the black and tans find them with guns, they're getting shot dead. So The IRA in the 1920s, they didn't use guns to train. They used Hurleys. So they would walk around the place with Hurleys. And if the soldiers stopped them, they'd say, "We're just playing hurling." But then as soon as the soldiers leave, the Hurley becomes a gun. And they practice formations, and they practice marching, and they practice ambushes using the Hurley as a gun. So it is worth looking at and investigating the similarity between Hurleys and shillelaghs, and the dual purpose of a Hurley also being a weapon. Now, that past fucking 10 minutes was from someone who knows fuck all about sports. So anyway, before I continue on with this hot take, let's have a little ocarina pause. So the ocarina pause is when there might be a digital advert inserted into the podcast. So I play my Spanish ceramic whistle as a warning.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, that was the ocarina pause. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page. Would you like to be a patron of the podcast? Please fucking do. Go to patreon.com/theblindboypodcast and consider giving me the price of a pint once a month, or 2 pints, or whatever you want to do. Okay? It's a suggested donation, and what this money does is it keeps me going. It keeps this podcast going. It provides me with a way to earn a living as an artist, to be coming at you with hot takes, and to be coming back every single week. Genuinely, the Patreon page changes my fucking life. It really, really changes my life. So if you listen to the podcast and you enjoy it, and you want to do something nice for me, if you become a patron, please do. It is fucking, it makes such a difference to me. And if you can't, you don't have to. But if you can and you're enjoying the podcast, this is a way to help me earn a living. So patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. Also, you can listen to this on Spotify. If you're listening on Spotify, please follow the podcast. If you're listening on iTunes, even if you don't, please go over to iTunes when the podcast is... I can't fucking say the word podcast, lads. I'm calling it a podcast like I'm from Ennis. If you enjoy the podcast, you're listening on iTunes, review it on iTunes, give it a couple of stars, like it, subscribe it, whatever the fuck. All that stuff does make a difference. If my podcast has lots of likes and subscriptions on iTunes, it's more likely to be seen by people who don't listen to it, and that's really important too. So thank you for that. And also a little plug for another podcast. A guest I had on this podcast before, David McWilliams, the economist, who is a lovely chap, he's just started his own podcast recently, which I think is called the David McWilliams Podcast. So give that a listen. Yart. So back to the faction fighting. One thing that's interesting about the factions around Munster in particular, because faction fighting, it was wide around Ireland, but It is very much a Munster thing. It was quite prevalent in Munster. So in the Limerick faction fight that I read out the account of there from 1810, that was between two gangs or factions, whatever way you want to call them. Same thing. And all the different factions, they had different names, they had different ways of identifying themselves, different ways of dressing, all these little codified ways to... Like sports teams, to say, I'm with this faction, I'm with another faction. So you had, there was factions called, in Limerick had the Caravats and the Shanavists. A Caravat is a Gaelic word. Caravat means like a tie. Do you know what I mean? Like, I suppose it comes from cravat. There has to be some type of association with cravat, because cravat is a thing you wear around your neck. But a caravat is like a tie that you wear around your neck. Shanavest, I don't know what that means. It looks anglicized. S-H-A-N-A-V-E-S-T-S. Because it says Shanna, Shan tends to mean, comes from the Gaelic meaning old. I don't know what the vest part is about. Does it mean old vest? I don't know. Was this gang called Old Vest? My favourite of the fucking Limerick gangs from the 1800s are the factions. That riot that I read out there, that the English priest saw, that was between two factions known as the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. And the biggest gangs in Limerick were the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. Which, firstly, is fucking hilarious. There's a Freudian level of beauty to that. Because you're fighting like fucking infants. And you're called the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. But where the name comes from is, it was a feud that started in a village called Athy in Limerick. Two men had a disagreement over the age of a pig. And they couldn't decide what age this pig was. So they became the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. Which I'm guessing, if you were present on the day and you got involved in this fight over how old this pig was, you were either on the team of the pig is 3 years old or the pig is 4 years old. And then you divide into two separate fucking groups and you have a huge fight. And the two gangs are born on this day, on that day, as the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. And those, that gang lasted nearly, well into the 1850s. And I nearly fucking wept when I read that. I just thought it was so fucking beautiful. It's so beautifully Limerick. The humour of that, that is fucking ridiculous. It's so surreal Limerick. But also what made my heart flutter is, you know, it's a disagreement about the age of a pig, which ends up resulting in this war. But that by itself is so fucking Irish. You can trace that back to, like, the greatest epic Irish battle that we have in mythology, in Irish mythology. And this is like a 1,000, 1,500 years old. More, the Táin Bó Cúaillíne, which is an epic Irish story about a huge battle that happens across Ireland. And Cú Chulainn is involved, and Queen Maeve is involved. And essentially what it boils down to is, it's Queen Maeve and some other fella, I can't remember the other fella's name, but it boils down to a disagreement over who owns the most cows. And Queen Maeve is like, I have the most cows, and the other fella's like, no, I have the most cows. And then there's one bull, the Táin Bó Cúaillíne, which is the brown bull, and this is the most prized bull in Ireland. And this massive battle wages all across the island of Ireland so that this brown bull can be won. The cattle raid of Cooley, it's also called. I don't know what the Táin Bó Cúaillíne means. I think it means the cattle raid of Cooley. I think that's what it means. But what you have is this giant war, this pitched battle, 1500, 2000 years ago, that happens over who owns the most cows and who's got the best cow. And then in Limerick in the early 1800s, you have these two gangs engaged in pitch battle because they can't decide the age of a fucking pig. And there's something really powerful about that in terms of the genetic memory of Irishness. I find that really beautiful and really apt. The culture and tradition of faction fighting, it kind of ended with the famine. That fight from Limerick, that huge big pitched battle, that was 1810. So that's a good 30 years before the famine hits. And those people were poor. And they were in slums, but they weren't starving. It wasn't the fucking Irish famine, the great genocide, whatever you want to call it, that took our population from 8 million to 4 million. It was the fucking eradication of the Irish by the British. That's what it was. Look, that's what I think it was. I know I had Finn Dwyer on the podcast before. It's a hard one to call, but the British powers that be really, really allowed half our population to die and didn't intervene, and they did the same shit in India. But the famine kind of ends the era of faction fighting, because when you are starving to death and everyone around you is dying, you won't be able to celebrate with these fights. It's not going to happen. People didn't have sex during the famine. Their bodies weren't functioning. Okay? This was a proper fucking famine with people eating grass and starving, dying on the roads. So faction fighting kind of ends around the 1840s in Ireland. There's not a lot of eyewitness accounts of faction fights, but one thing I did find that was interesting was a Limerick man, and this would have been recorded in 1920, I believe. Now, this man was 85 years of age at the time, so he would have been a child in Limerick at the time of the faction fights. So, but they did interview him and they asked him, do you remember the culture and tradition of faction fights? And I'm going to read this out because I find this really fucking interesting, because like I said, there's two sides of the narrative about faction fights. There's the British side, which is we are drunken savages who kick the fucking heads off each other. And then there's the Irish side, which is this was a celebration, it was a sport. I know it seems strange to you, but try living in our shoes and let's see how you have fun. So this man called Richard Denehan, here's his account. As long as I can remember, one of the first things I ever heard spoken of around the fire was the faction and the fights that went on between the different factions. I remember it well, though. I was young at the time. I don't know at all what started the factions the first day. I knew people who were of different factions, yet they were very friendly to one another. They used to have great preparations for the faction fights, selecting and dressing sticks. They used to fight with two sticks, the bull chain. It was about 4 feet long. Sometimes they used to put lead in the top of the stick, or the blacksmith would put a band of iron around it. This made the end of the stick firm and heavy, and a stroke from it would break a bone or split a skull. The other stick was a short one, about a foot long, and it was very short now. The purpose of this stick was to stop the other one. Some people used to prefer to fight with the bull tine alone. They used to practice with the sticks from their youth, and some men became so skilled at it that the two of them could fight and never touch each other. In each district, there was a special faction, or maybe the one faction might be spread over a great area. There was a faction called the Tree-year-olds, and another called the Fire-olds, and they were spread all over the county. I used to hear that these two factions came into being as a result of an argument that arose over the sale of a pig. This was mostly in East Limerick and Tipperary, but it was elsewhere also. I remember seeing a man below in Rathkeel one day, and he was drunk, and he says, "I'm a 4-year-old," he used to say, waiting for anyone to say that he was a 3-year-old. The faction that my father, God rest him, was in was the Colleen faction. There was another faction called the Black Mulvihills. These two factions used often try their strength to pang one another. 'Twas a law around here that if a man married a girl from the Black Mulvihill faction, he'd have to fight with the Black Mulvihills, and 'twould be the same if a Black Mulvihill man married a Colleen woman. So that right there, that's straight from the fucking horse's mouth. That's an owl lad being interviewed in 1820 talking about the culture of faction fighting around Limerick and Tipperary in the 1800s, do you know? And that man is straight up saying this was not, there was what wasn't animosity. There was sportsmanship. There was a friendliness about it, even though it was an expression of violence. And I don't know, like, I mean, what's the, like, you look at MMA, that's two people kicking the fucking heads off each other. They're not using sticks. They're not trying to kill each other. I mean, in these situations, obviously someone's going to fucking die. If you've got a stick with iron at the end of it and you smash someone's fucking head in, someone's going to die. But this didn't appear to be an act of hatred or violence or vendetta. It appeared to be much more of a sport. what I find really interesting there now is, like, and this is my first time hearing about this, is tonight when he spoke there about the faction known as the Black Mulvihills, that if you weren't a Black Mulvihill and you married a woman who was belonging to the Black Mulvihill, you had to fight the Black Mulvihills. That reminds me of our song that we wrote years ago, the Rubber Bandit song, Roisin, I Wanna Fight Your Father. I don't know where that song comes from. Where does that song come from? Yes, that song comes from a story, a lad we knew in Limerick who was having sex with a girl on her couch, and her dad came in and he stood up to the father wearing the condom on a boner and claimed the father to a fight. And this was a Limerick story about a lad we knew. That's where Roisin, I Wanna Fight Your Father comes from. But I'm interested in, there's some similarity there. This is that part of me that's interested in epigenetic memory. You know, how elements, what part of myself and Mr. Crome found that story so exciting and so funny that it needed to be regaled and turned into song? And is that our Limerick Irish genetic memory through the years? Something about that guiding us towards that particular story as being the one that deserves an epic romantic story and works as an Irish thing. I don't know. That's just me searching my brain, searching my unconscious. But I find that interesting. So where I want to kind of go with this now is, faction fighting in Ireland, it ends around the time of the famine. And it doesn't really reemerge that much after the famine. But where does faction fighting go? Well, it ends up in New York. In the 1830s, the 1840s, there was massive, massive migration of Irish people to New York who were escaping the famine. And the vast majority of Irish people who went to New York, like, I think in 1840, one in every three people in New York spoke Gaelic. They didn't even speak English. They were Irish speakers. So there was massive, massive amounts of incredibly poor Irish peasants in New York. Now, where they all went to, it was an area in Lower Manhattan. I believe it's now quite close to Wall Street. And this area was known as the Five Points District of New York. It's now gone. It was the Five Points. There was an area around New York called the Collect Pond, which was this kind of marshy type of land. And they'd started off building kind of posh houses there in the late 1700s for rich people. But all the buildings began to sink because it was being built on this pond. So everyone moved out and it became what, it's considered the most notorious slum that ever existed. And it was populated equally by, because we're talking 1820, 1830, 1840 for the Five Points. It was populated by very, very poor Irish people and recently freed African slaves. And it's the old classic. It was the first New York melting pot. Irish people and African slaves, freed slaves, lived together in harmony for the first maybe 20 years. They were, it's the thing I mentioned, that Irish people were not considered white in America in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. By white, I mean not the colour of their skin as such, but race as a social construct. They were not considered to be white people. This is evident in the racist caricatures and cartoons that the quote-unquote nativist Americans were writing about the Irish at the time and the British. The ruling class in New York in the 1800s were essentially the grandchildren of English people and Dutch people, but mostly English. And they had a massive, massive anti-Irishness, anti-Catholic, anti-black rhetoric, and for this reason the Irish and the freed African slaves found a sense of community and harmony together. From this, you know, we do get like tap dancing, you know, tap dancing, which is like tap dancing comes from an African dance called the African Shuffle. It was basically in the Five Pint slum, you had Irish music, you know, jigs and reels, and then Africans dancing to Irish music. And you often had dance competitions between the Irish and the Africans, and from this came tap dancing. That's where tap dancing comes from. Also, there's a lot of words in African American vernacular that trace their roots to Irish words, like you dig me. That comes from the Irish, I'm digging to. Do you understand? It means the same thing. So at the start, that's what the Five Pints was. This notorious slum, like Charles Dickens wrote about it. It was so bad. With tenement housing. Incredibly unsafe tenement housing. And massive violence. It was ungovernable. So what emerges in the Five Pints district, and this is, like, if you want to know what I'm talking about, if you've ever seen the Martin Scorsese film Gangs of New York, which is, it's an okay film, right? I don't really like it. It could be a lot more historically accurate. It's not. It's very dramatized. I think it was a missed opportunity. But elements of trying to capture the era are correct. The Five Pints district is Gangs of New York. Early American gang culture, you trace directly to the factions of Tipperary, Limerick, Clare, North Cork. That's a fact. So that's what happened to the Irish factions and the Irish faction fighting. It found itself to the streets of the New York slums of the Five Pint District. But what happens is it stops becoming a sport then, because now it's more about survival, because you had the nativist gangs who were essentially working class, poor, nativist Americans. They belonged to political parties like called the Know Nothings. They were the grandchildren of British people whose, you know, grandparents would have fought to get American independence, and they believed that they were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and America was their land, and they were very much against these new freed African slaves and these new Catholic Irish. So faction fighting now became about self-defense. So many gangs emerged to fight, to defend themselves essentially in the Five Pints. But what they take is the traditions that you see from Limerick and Tipperary and all this. Who I want to focus on specifically is a guy called John Morrissey. John Morrissey was from Tipperary, born in the 1830s, born in Templemore in Tipperary, which is, you know, Templemore is now where the Garda training college is. The Irish police are trained in Templemore today, where John Morrissey comes from. And, you know, there's a roasting hot take. You could make an argument that the Irish guards as such take a faction fighting tradition, because they refuse to use guns and they've got big sticks and they'll bust your head in. Do you know what I mean? Maybe that's too hot a take. But John Morrissey was from Templemore, County Tipperary. He would have been part of the Munster faction fight scene. He comes from that culture. And John Morrissey is considered to be the founding member of one of the largest gangs in New York called the Dead Rabbits. So if you remember the Gangs of New York film, the biggest gang in it was the Dead Rabbits. And the Dead Rabbits was founded by Liam Neeson, and then Leonardo DiCaprio is his son, and he brings the Dead Rabbits again, and they fight Daniel Day-Lewis, who is Bill the Butcher. Okay, so the real man, John Morrissey from Tipperary, who comes from the Munster faction fight fucking culture, like, Liam Neeson's character isn't real, neither is Leonardo DiCaprio's character. Both Leonardo DiCaprio's character and Liam Neeson together, and a little bit of Brendan Gleeson's character, the three of them together are John Morrissey. They didn't exist. John Morrissey did. He founded the Dead Rabbits on Munster traditions and principles. And the one person that was real is Daniel Day-Lewis's character, Bill the Butcher. Bill the Butcher, whose real name was William Poole, he was a real guy. He was a nativist, very aggressive, violent, feared ganglord who was anti-Irish and anti-black, and the Dead Rabbits and many other gangs would join together in huge faction fights to the death to fight the nativist gangs. And this is the origins of essentially American gang culture, but it has its roots in Munster. So the Dead Rabbits, we don't know what the Dead Rabbits meant. Again, it's something that's probably lost in translation that has elements of Irish slang. They don't think dead means like actually dead, but rather cool, like dead as in cool. Do you know, that's the way that we'll say dead in Irish. That's dead class. And rabid, it's not rabid, it was rabid, which means like rabid, like fierce. So cool and fierce is what the Dead Rabbits would have meant, I think. And they used to identify themselves by, again, a way that they dressed. And they would carry around big long pikes with dead rabbits on the top of them. Or some say that they used to throw a dead rabbit into the ring and this is when a fight would start. But essentially, these huge pitched battles, this comes from the Irish faction fight scene that you have around fucking Munster and Limerick and Tip specifically. And this lad, John Morrissey, who was a very hard fucker from Tip, starts off as a bare knuckle boxer in the Five Points and becomes a bit of a legend as a bare knuckle boxer. But where things get really fucking interesting with the faction fight tradition, like when you think of, you know, the Italians hadn't come yet, really. The wave of Italian migration happens later. But if you look at, you think of, Jesus, why are the mafia still going? Why is the Italian mafia still a thing? And where are the Irish gangs? Why did Irish gang culture effectively end in the 1920s? And you could say that it ended really in the 1890s, because gangs like the fucking Dead Rabbits and shit like that really ended at the start of the 20th century. And there were Irish gangsters, but they were absorbed into the Cosa Nostra Italian tradition, really. Well, what happened with the Irish immigrants is they, instead of forming violent criminal gangs, the roots of the American Democratic Party, Barack Obama's party, fucking Joe Biden's party, Hillary Clinton's party, the roots of the American Democratic Party comes from those Irish in New York who formed, the violence quickly turned political. And the Dead Rabbits and the Bowery Boys and the Plug Uglies and all these other Irish gangs would, what they started to do was to intimidate voters into, you see it illustrated in Gangs of New York, the film, through Brendan Gleeson's character. You see him moving away from being this brutal man with a shillelagh who used to smash people's heads in, instead into becoming a local politician. The Irish became politicians. The Irish figured out that if they mobilise together in that way, they can achieve political aims. And the roots of the Republican Party then, that's Bill the Butcher. Now the reason John Morrissey is important, John Morrissey is the man who killed Bill the Butcher. He murdered Bill the Butcher, so that's why Leonardo DiCaprio's character is kind of him. So he murders Bill the Butcher in real life. But then he goes on to become a US congressman. John Morrissey from Tip, the faction fighter, becomes an actual proper US congressman. And if you look him up in the history, he's there remembered really, not as a bare knuckle boxer, not as a gang leader, but as a Democratic Party fucking US congressman. In fact, he was a senator. He was a state senator. And that's what John Morrissey from Tip did. So from the Irish faction fight culture, the Munster faction fight culture, the other thing that the Irish did is unions became a huge thing. Using the fraternity and unity of faction culture and instead forming unions on the docks, we'll say, amongst workers. Also, using the violence to... Why do you think the cliche in American films is that the cops are always Irish? Why are so many police Irish? Because that's what they fucking did. You have a very poor underclass who managed to... Some will say it's how the Irish found their whiteness, found their privilege. But the Irish used that violence to then become the New York fucking police and break people's heads open. As the violent New York police, you have the fire department. You see a huge part in the Five Points District is you used to have... There was no one fire brigade. There was multiple fucking fire brigades. And the fire brigades essentially came from the different gangs that can trace their roots to the factions. And a building could be on fire. And you'd have two fire brigades in pitched battle with each other over who can put the fucking fire out. So that's the legacy of these Irish head-crushing lunatics. They became the foundations of violent power in the US, the police, the politicians. And the kind of glassy-eyed harmony that I described there earlier about the Five Points and how the Irish and the freed African slaves lived in harmony. They did for about 20 years. They had a common struggle, a common discrimination. The systems of power that be did not view the Irish or the African Americans as being any different. So a fraternity was found within that. There was a huge amount of intermarriage, a mixing of cultures. There was no animosity. You also find those Irish are coming from a penal law system. So that degree of massive systematic racial oppression that the Irish actually experienced in Ireland, they found a common understanding with the systematic oppression that the freed slaves were then experiencing in New York. Now, how does it end? It doesn't end very well at all. It ends with the New York draft riots, which what was happening was the American Civil War was happening down south. The newly arrived Irish are coming straight off the boat, starving, dying on coffin ships. And a lot of them were simply being led into the country, immediately being signed into the army and being sent to fight for the government of the United States as such against the Confederates down south. So this led to an awful lot of resentment. You also had two, like, if a rich, not even rich, but somewhat moneyed American man in New York was called to draft, and this lad was said, you have to go now and fight for the government against the Confederates down south. A lot of them didn't have to go to war. What they could do instead was simply pay money and get an Irishman to fight in their place. And that's what happened. So a lot of these Irish faction fighting men came to America and were immediately sent to die in the war. And a draft was being brought in that was going to send more of them to war. And what happens is these Irish start to think, hold on a second, we're only going to war to free the African slaves. So then they took their anger out on the Africans. And the massive violence and faction culture turned into huge lynching and the hanging of black people in New York around 1860 something, I believe, or 1850. But there was massive lynchings by the Irish against black people. And also from that, what emerges is a massively, massively racist Irish-American culture where the black people are viewed as competition for the same jobs, for the lowest jobs that are available. So a lot of shit that's really sick with America today, and a lot of the times that you see some right-wing fucking prick with an Irish name in American politics, or you see an Irish policeman shooting fucking black people today, a policeman with an Irish name, you can trace it all back to that. It's a culture that starts there, and that's well documented. So I don't want to be all glassy-eyed about this lovely moment of harmony between Irish people and African Americans in New York. It was a brief period. You know, as I mentioned with that podcast with Spike Lee that I did before, Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, like, he was traveling to Ireland. He came to Limerick in 1842, I believe. Like, Frederick Douglass spoke in Limerick to the Irish people who were fleeing the famine with Daniel O'Connell, specifically to say to the Irish, when you go to New York, you must join with the black people. You're going to see freed slaves. Here is their story. This is what they escaped. You need to find fraternity with these people and you need to help their struggle. Frederick Douglass and Daniel O'Connell tried their best. That's not how it worked. As soon as they got to America, they had to violently fight for a position of privilege, which they achieved by becoming the vicious, well-practiced, violent attack dog of the grandchildren of the Brits. And that's what happened. All right, that was a roaster of a fucking take. Christ. As is always with a hot take, I'd say 95% of all the history that I spoke about there is correct. I might be wrong for a little bit whenever I'm freestyling, but sure, that's it. If you're listening to this podcast in an academic sense, then shame on you, sir. The hot take for me in this podcast, what it is, it's an interesting point. That's what I want. I want to speak and entertain, and I will never willingly mislead, but I will recount from memory and add citations when I can to give you an entertaining version of history. You know, and that's what the hot take is. I'll leave you go. Have a tremendous time. I'll talk to you next week. I really enjoyed this. This was a nice little hot take. It's something I'm passionate about. It's new knowledge in my head. I got to get it off my chest. Many wide sweeping theories that I have. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did doing it. And it was an absolute pleasure. Have a lovely week. Go fuck yourselves. I'll be back next week. Don't know what I'm going to talk about.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.